Hi folks, just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest Nick Pettigrew, all about the world's worst inventors, and oh boy is this a good episode. We've been looking forward to doing this for a while. Some little bits of housekeeping. First of all, hello, welcome to all the lovely new listeners who've appeared in our downloads in the last week or so. We believe a number of you have been sent our way by our good friends at Festival of the Spoken Nerd. We had an ad run on their new podcast, A Podcast of Unnecessary Detail. Long-time listeners of our show will know that Helen Arney, one of the Spoken Nerd team, has been on our show talking about the world's worst element, and they very kindly gave us a little shout-out. If you listen ahead to our episode, you'll hear that we have an ad for theirs running on our show. Podcasts supporting each other. So thank you to everyone who has ventured our way. We hope you stay very long. We promise not to make direct eye contact or try and force you to engage in small talk. Don't worry, nerds, this is a safe space. If you do want to sample a little bit of what we're like and see if this is the show for you, well, yeah, this episode you're about to listen to is a really good example of the kind of thing we're into. All sorts of brilliant trivia and fantastic heroic failure. We also recommend you listen to such favourite episodes as World's Worst Pirate, World's Worst Doctor, World's Worst Map, which we did recently. World's Worst Science Communicator with Dr. Lucy Rogers. That was great. There's all sorts in there. There's a bit of something for everyone. So if you've come to us in the recent influx of listeners, we hope you'll dig around into our back catalog and see if there's any topics that particularly tickle your fancies. We also have to give a thank you to our latest Patreon donor. That's Andrew Clegg, who has chucked us $3 a month to become a Patreon donor. Thank you so much, Andrew. We very much appreciate that. If you haven't ventured onto our Patreon page, you can visit patreon.com/worstfootforward. And on there, you can find different tiers you can support us at, where you can get extra bonus content each month, suggest episodes for the podcast, even appear as a judge or indeed a guest on the show. And we recently passed our target number of donors, where we're now starting to write a book of the podcast. We're compiling some of our favorite stories from the 180 or so episodes of the show we've done, putting them all together into an encyclopedia of heroic failure. And if you're on Patreon, again, if you're one of our Patreon donors, you'll get little sneak previews of what we're working on. Ben and I have been working on an introductory chapter for the book, and we suspect we will share that with our Patreon donors in the next month or so. So, yeah, get on board that train. We've got other targets for when we hit certain thresholds of donors in terms of trying to do more live shows, doing a special Dungeons & Dragons episode, a Worst Foot Forward film club where we watch along with some of our the films that are featured in our episodes about various movie genres, all sorts of things. So go and check that out as well. You can find us online in all sorts of spaces as usual. You can go to Twitter at Worst Foot. That's where we're most active. We're also on Facebook if you look for Worst Foot Forward. And our website is worstfootforwardpodcast.com. You can also drop us an email if you want to get in touch. Various people have been doing that at worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, long-time listener Tikva, for sending us a lovely message wishing us a happy Jewish New Year. As an Irish Catholic, I've never been wished a happy Jewish New Year before. I'm very excited. And lots of ways to get in touch with us. We hope you'll all continue doing that, especially with another dreaded lockdown seemingly incoming. So we will do our best throughout all of the dark times ahead. God, that just makes it sound like they're inevitable. Oh well, lean into it. We will do our best to keep you guys entertained and informed to the best of our ability for as long as we can. So with that in mind, we hope that you'll enjoy the upcoming episode about the world's worst inventors. Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. And I'm standing before you this week, dragons, asking for £2 million for 5% of my business, which is based on my brand new invention. I call it the podcast. Hey, switching to a plant-based diet and trying to increase the number of peas you eat? Good for you, champ. Better get shelling those suckers, but wait! Damn, if you eat more and more peas, aren't you going to suffer from a backlog of pods, all in need of disposal? And composting bins are just so small these days in the modern home, and simply dropping them out of your window is too obvious. The neighbours will know who the litter bug in their building is. Darn, looks like you won't be able to throw back those little green marbles like a Hollywood Golden Age star throwing back the diet pills. But that's where my invention comes in. I give you the podcast.
You may think it looks remarkably like a tiny catapult, but it's so much more. Simply point it out your open window and fire. The launch pad has been shaped to specifically mould around the typical pea pod, and is designed from our patented forgetful foam, so that when the pod is launched, it travels faster and farther than your typical pod disposal system. Not only that, but the handle is ergonomically designed, so you can shell and dispel with no danger of carpal tunnel. From the makers of the Sprout Trebuchet, we bring you the podcast. And if you order the podcast today, you'll get a free gift alongside it. Have you got more asparagus spears than you want? Then you'll be delighted with this handy asparagus ballista. Warning, vegetables fired at household pets may have unwanted side effects. Retailing for the reasonable price of $99.99 plus postage and packaging, peas not included, we're sure the podcast will leave your fellow vegans green with envy and earn you, dragons, plenty of green. And alongside me is the not-so-silent partner in my failing enterprises, Ben Vandeveld.
I'm out.
I've heard that before.
Yeah. I think what you've basically just described in that introduction is what the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals will use as weapons in their paramilitary wing. Yeah.
What that launch basically is the first draft of a Dragon's Den page and the first draft of a podcast introduction.
The thing is, that's what we're all doing now. I think like five, six months into the pandemic, you, me and all the other creators are out there going, we're going to have to become entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And the next episode of Dragon's Den is just going to be actor after screenwriter after comedian weeping into Peter Jones's lap going, please, you don't need all those millions.
I'm looking forward to like 10, 15 years time when, you know, we've basically still been in lockdown forever, where someone can go in Dragon's Den and pitch the idea of people sitting in a live venue and watching some sort of entertainment on a stage, perhaps. Like retro, it'll bring it back in again.
Right, before we get too wistfully nostalgic from a yet unspooled future, let's meet this week's guest. He was an anti-social behaviour officer for over a decade, from bothersome neighbours with a fondness for crack cocaine and loud dance music to those being racially abused every day. Nick's job involved keeping the community happy, or at least away from each other's throats. He's got a background in comedy and was a stand-up comedian for several years, taking two successful shows to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, before realising that working as an ASBO officer, he was likely to meet more mentally well-adjusted humans who contribute to society in a greater way, whilst having less freeform narcissistic personality disorders. His comedy writing has been published by Shortlist and The Telegraph, and he was a regular writer for The Daily Mash for over 8 years. More recently, he's just published his first book, Antisocial, all about his experiences of working in the social care sector, which has been described as hysterically funny and moving by Frankie Boyle and darkly comic by Kathy Burke. On Twitter, where I first encountered him, he is a consistently vituperative fighter of good fights, incinerator of tedious conservatives, supporter of Liverpool, lover of the Beatles, and deployer of a mean Jimmy Hill meme. It is a delight to welcome a man who has seen it all, chronicled most of it, and probably would like to forget large chunks. Welcome all, Nick Pettigrew.
Hello, everyone. Hello. I've never been called vituperative before. That's a first.
Because I can tell you've got that nice calming timbre of voice to deal with, you know, a crackhead on a roof.
Instead of fiddler on the roof.
Yeah.
Tradition. Hey.
Yeah. was a lot of your job then just being the calm adult in the room?
Yeah, it was about maybe being sort of a mediator as well as as part cop, part social worker, part youth worker and a little bit of everything else. If you speak to any frontline person, whether that's a copper or a social worker, whatever, you've got to be a bit detached and a bit calm and a bit sort of trying to see stuff from a distance. You'd sit there and listen to madness and have to treat it with respect and calmness and professionalism and remembering that you had a mortgage.
I mean, listen, our house is an absolute banger, so there's not a problem.
Just for our American listeners, you do the job that basically a lot of armed cops in America get to, isn't that right? That, you know, there's a lot of debate in America over a sort of police violence at the moment about, you know, people being called out for mental health issues, where there might be people better positioned
there's a big thing about the people who need help not having the right person getting phoned to them. There was a case quite recently about an autistic guy that got shot because the police who attended didn't understand the care sort of needs that this guy had. So there's a little bit of that in it as well. But it's just about people at the end of their tether and sort of bumping up against their neighbours, which during COVID, people have been bumping up to their neighbours an awful lot than they used to. So it was just about trying to find a solution to that that stopped everyone from getting at each other's throats and kept everyone out of court or out of prison.
I sort of feel that any American cop watching anyone in Britain do what you do is the equivalent of watching someone at a safari park go into the lion enclosure wearing nothing but a set of chitterling trousers. And like, how...
It was, you just sort of learned on the job about learning risk and knowing when to walk away. Really early in the job, I had a job where I had to go and tell somebody off. And stupidly, I did it in their house, which was a mistake. So the mum was kicking off at me and saying, "How dare you say this about my son?" And the son was sat there literally with a pit bull sat in front of him. And if that wasn't threatening enough, he said, "You're lucky my brother isn't here because you'd be bang in trouble right now." So I sort of said, okay, I think we're done. I think I've made my point.
Yeah. Dude, that's the point where you hear like a rattling knock on the door and it's like, oh, Bobo's home. And he walks in taking the door lintel with him.
All the lights seem to go out.
Yeah.
You're clearly very good at reading the room then. What would you say that you're the worst at in the world?
I've been thinking about this and it's weird. The things I really like or the things I'm worst at, if that makes sense. If I can't do something, I really admire it and I really like sort of watching it. So like singing is like music and stuff like that I really love. And my mum once told me when I was singing, she said, "You sound like a nanny goat shitting on tin."
And your mother was Julie Andrews.
So that's one thing. Like dancing is another thing that I always look like somebody trying to move a wardrobe down a spiral staircase. I just, no physical coordination. Like sport, I love. I mean, Ben talked before, big Liverpool fan. I love sport and I love watching sport, but I can't do it because I have no sort of physical grace whatsoever. I mean, like snooker, my highest snooker break is one.
I mean, snooker tables are quite big, though.
They are.
Yeah.
The first time I played snooker, I was like, why are we playing this on the entire state of Nebraska?
Yeah. But
there's something very genteel about snooker, because, you know, I love the fact that snooker is this game of high physics and intellect, yet is traditionally a working class game, really, when you think of where many of the greats come from. And the fact that there's this gentility about it, it's a beautifully carpeted table, and all of the players are dressed as boxing referees. It's got a...
Professional snooker's lost its roots. And I think for the final, should be played in a small room with a row of pound coins on the side.
Royal Rumble style.
Yeah. And then every now and again, when they're trying to do a shot, somebody just brushes past them with like a tray of drinks.
There's one side of the table is a little too close to a wall.
You have to use a small cue for that one.
Yeah.
Well, because when I was a kid, I had a little, 6x3 foot snooker table in our spare room. And yeah, it didn't fit. And if you wanted to take any shots from the balk area, you had to literally climb inside a wardrobe. It's like, hang on, I think that the Ice Queen is helping me with this shot.
I think, if I remember rightly, Alex Higgins beat Mr. Tumnus in the final of his first world championship.
Hi, I'm Helen Arney. I'm one third of the science comedy trio Festival of the Spoken Nerd, and I'm here to tell you about a podcast of unnecessary details. If you like the way that Worst Foot Forward investigates the weird and not so wonderful world in categories like Worst Scientist or Worst Element, that's the episode you've heard me in before, you'll probably enjoy a podcast of unnecessary detail. Every episode starts with three nerds and a single word, and heads off in three different directions to reveal some really bizarre corners of science, maths, and technology. Things that don't seem too promising at first, but become fascinating when you get down to the nitty and or gritty. Why do squid have donut-shaped brains? What does a 1970s spacecraft have to do with credit card fraud? How is a violin just like a tiny earthquake? Find us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts by searching for Unnecessary Detail, or head to festivalofthespokennerd.com/podcast.
This week, we are dealing with a topic that's been on our to-do list for quite a long time, and we're delighted that Nick has stepped up to the plate to take this on. Ben and I have long wanted to talk about the world's worst inventors, and so Ben is going to be the first person to lead us into the lab. What have you created for us?
We did have an email recently from, I think it was Jenny D'Souza, a listener, who said to look at some patents, because there's all sorts of ridiculous patents, particularly in America. For the first one, I looked at a rather particular kind of mousetrap. Now, do you gents know when and where the first mousetrap is believed to have been invented?
I'm going to say ancient Egypt, because that's normally a good spread bet.
They loved cats, so that's a solid bet.
And I'm going to extrapolate from the possibly apocryphal story that we've had on the show before, that Sir Isaac Newton invented the cat flap, to go that if he had a cat, before he got the cat, he must have had a mouse problem. So the precursor to inventing the cat flap was his inventing a mouse trap.
Nick's closer. It was actually the ancient Greeks. The first reference to it is in a piece called The Battle of Frogs and Mice by Pigres of Halicarnassus, and he refers to a wooden snare, a destroyer of mice, which they call a trap.
That's a branding that some company should bring back.
I am wooden snare.
Destroyer of mice. Because, I mean, obviously a famous inventor would be Oppenheimer, who came to regret his invention of the atomic bomb. Destroyer of worlds. And next door, there's the guy who invented a mouse trap.
I want to talk about someone from much closer in time to us, a chap called James A. Williams from Fredonia in Texas. And yes, I am aware that Fredonia is a made-up country in a Marx Brothers film, but, you know, in the land of America, all places exist. Yeah. And he developed a new kind of trap by which animals which burrow into the ground can be destroyed. And he took inspiration from many 19th century burglar alarms that involved sort of jury-rigging a weapon and lever contraption so as to maim or kill any person or thing opening the door or window to which it is attached. This is all a very roundabout way, gentlemen, of telling you that James A. Williams invented the mousetrap pistol.
No.
Yes, there is an amazing picture of in the patent of a mouse stepping on the trap and facing a Colt 45 right in its face.
Because the only way to destroy a mouse is a good guy with a pistol.
Yeah.
The bullets are going to be bigger than the mouse in a Colt 45.
Yeah, there doesn't have to be anything left of him, mate. William C. Hooker, who's the man who actually designed the classic trap that we know and love from Tom and Jerry cartoons, he didn't develop that till 12 years later. So it feels like James Williams shot for the moon. He went a bit too high. Obviously, you've got to shoot for the moon because it's made of cheese and that's where all the mice are.
Yeah. Ben looks so pleased with himself to have stumbled into that particular joke.
The other stupid patent that I found, this is US patent number 3,216,423 for those of you playing along at home. And it is developed by Bronx residents George and Charlotte Blonsky. And it involves the use of the centrifuge that was very prevalent in the 1960s when they invented it, because it was used for training astronauts going on the Apollo missions. But this was in a very different setting. This was a centrifuge used in labor wards. That's right, lads, it's the spinning birthing table.
We're gonna spin those babies out of you.
The expectant mother is strapped further into a frame that spins round and round and round, generating a centripetal force. And the theory is that eases the baby's passage. My favourite bit is, just in case the baby shoots out of the woman at several miles an hour, there is a pocket-shaped reception net at the end of it. So going back to snooker, you can literally pot your child.
That is amazing.
This is America. Shouldn't they have somebody with a baseball catcher's mitt?
Yes. Doing like little finger signals to the mother just before they say you're right. the finger signals are probably just crossed fingers and hoping for the best.
So if she has triplets, then she's out.
Yeah.
Is that happy?
Yes. There's two main candidates that I've looked at. The first one, there is, as ever, a cracking old list on Wikipedia, dripping with schadenfreude, which is inventors killed by their own inventions.
Yeah.
So the first chap I'm going to talk about is an Austrian called Franz Reichelt. Born in Austria, but had French citizenship, and he was sometimes referred to as the Flying Tailor. And as we're going to see, that is a rather tragicomic epithet. Obviously, since the dawn of the aviation age in the late 18th century, when the Montgolfier brothers went up in their hot air balloon, lots of different people were trying to work out various ways to create a parachute, particularly the ones as we know them now, parachutes that can be stored in a bag and then opened manually, because the first parachute jump was in 1783 by a chap called Louis Sebastian Lenormand, but that was an already open parachute and he dove off a tower, and it was essentially a glorified miniature balloon.
Yeah.
And Reichelt's notion was to create a parachute that was part of a suit, so sort of like the ones that currently do exist. I forget the specific name of them, but it's similar to the sort of things that your man Baumgartner used when he dived from the moon into the sea.
The ones that make you look like a flying fox.
Precisely. He spent ages trying to design these things, firstly beginning using lots of dummies, and they'd be equipped with foldable silk wings. Obviously silk being very light but very strong, that was a decent idea. But it seems that he spent a lot of the 1910s dropping dummies out of Parisian fifth floor windows. None of his tests proved successful, and I think possibly the villain of this piece is Colonel Lalance, who wrote to the Aero Club de France offering a prize of 10,000 francs for a safe parachute of an aviator, and that was double the prize he'd offered the year before. And Reichelt, clearly this was a red rag to a bull for him, and he kept refining his design, and his notion of why all the dummies had failed was because, painfully tragically, he said that he was dropping them from too low a height, and so they didn't have time for the parachute to open.
See, I think at this point the villain of the piece is actually gravity.
Yeah.
1912, he finally received permission to climb the Eiffel Tower and drop dummies off the first level, which was 57 meters above the ground. The police, their chief of police, when questioned after his death, said, "I absolutely didn't give him permission to jump off himself." And I think that a lot of the authorities and his mates thought that there was no way he was actually going to do it himself. And there's a picture of him on the morning of the jump wearing the suit, and it sort of looks like a very bulked out mechanics onesie.
The entire newsreel is on his Wikipedia page, in fact.
Yeah. There's an awful thing in the newsreel when he jumps. There's a really poignant moment where he almost like, I've got to go through my convictions here, don't I? I've been beating this drum for years. I really need to sort of show that I believe in this. But there's a pause where you kind of look at it and go, you know this isn't going to work, don't you?
It's 40 seconds from the point that he's on the ledge on this first floor balcony to him actually jumping. And it's like, he does that thing where you're slightly scared of heights, where you're like rocking slightly and then stopping himself and rocking. You know the ending before it comes.
And also because he's got a classic early 20th century tash and flat cap going on, it sort of adds to the comedy.
Yeah,
you'd think the drag factor of his mustache would have kept him for a little bit longer at least.
It was very tempting to choose him, not least because one of his replies just before he is about to jump off, he's asked by one of his associates there, "Are you sure you don't want to do this with a dummy?" And he says, "I want to try the experiment myself without trickery, as I intend to prove the worth of my invention." And then he again says to them, "You're going to see how my 72 kilos and my parachute will give your arguments the most decisive of denials." And he was very right until the very last word of that sentence, wasn't he? His final words are simply, "A biento."
Yeah.
"See you soon."
Yeah.
The final words on him are, the next day, a journalist writing in Le Gallois, presumably writing in tar, suggested that only half the term mad genius applied to him.
Oh. Wow. The French taking no prisoners there.
None whatsoever. Well, this is going to be my choice. This is a gentleman who is one of the most prolific inventors of all time. But as we've learned before, being prolific doesn't necessarily mean that you're any good. This is a chap called Yoshira Nakamatsu. He was born on the 26th of June, 1928. He is still with us at the age of 92, which he considers to be solid middle age. More on that in a moment.
Oh, no.
He is also better known as Dr. Nakamatsu. In interviews, he talks about his creativity process, which includes listening to Beethoven in his specially designed elevator that he believes help him think better, before retiring to his calm room, which is a bathroom constructed without nails, tiled to 24-karat gold, which apparently blocks television and radio wave and encourages creative thinking, which he does, like Martin Luther, on the toilet. And then, having done that, he will then go to his indoor swimming pool, where he will dive underwater and hold his breath for as long as possible, because he claims that a lack of oxygen to the brain during the dive makes inventions occur to him 0.05 seconds before death. So he will then surface just before he passes out, and that's when he has his inspiration.
Is he like a Roald Dahl character with like his magic elevator, his golden toilet and his thinking swimming pool?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you about his children later on, and they do sound like people who might end up in a chocolate-based penal facility.
I like the idea of inventions coming to you like 0.5 of a second before you drown, because in Titanic, as Jack was sinking, just before he died, he went, "Oh, life jackets."
Like some rogues that we've met on this podcast before, as I said, he predicts he's going to live until the age of 144. And, you know, to be fair to him, he comes from a famously long-lived country. And he believes that the right food and drink, moderate exercise, and an unflagging love life will keep him alive till 2072. Of course you do, you sly dog.
It's for the good of my health, dear.
Yeah.
Doing this for science.
Oh, no, we got to do it twice, because one has to be a control shark. he believes that you should subsist on one meal a day, and that should be low in oil, no more than 700 calories. So his own diet consists of a single serving of pureed seaweed, cheese, yogurt, eel, eggs, beef, dry shrimp, and chicken livers. He seasons it with his own Dr. Nakamatsu Rebody 55, a dietary supplement containing 55 grains and several mystery ingredients. And to be fair, fucker's still alive.
Well,
so.
Yep.
See, with a diet like that, how does he have regular sex? Because his farts must be quite something.
Well, I mean, I reckon they must be quite something, but I reckon they also, if he times the right, would propel him quite pneumatically into Mrs. Nakamatsu.
He's building his own inbuilt thrusters.
No woman on earth wants to hear thrusters engage before coitus begins.
Are his inventions all to do with sort of longevity and supplements and stuff?
Oh, no. He has, at the current count, 3,377 patents, or three times as many as Thomas Edison. When asked about it a few years ago, he said, "The big difference between Edison and me is that he died when he was 84, while I am now just in the middle of my life." Let me give you a list of some of the things that he has created. He claims that he invented the floppy disk. This is almost certainly bullshit, but we'll be back on that later. Also, the CD, the DVD, the fax machine, the taxi meter, the digital watch, the karaoke machine, cinemascope, spring-loaded shoes, fuel cell-powered boots, an invisible bee-bust bra, the water-powered engine, the world's tiniest air conditioner, a self-defense wig that can be swung at an attacker, a pillow that prevents drivers from nodding off behind the wheel, a musical golf putter that pings when the ball is struck properly, a perpetual motion machine.
Yay! Bingo!
And last of all, the Love Jet, a sexual enhancement product which he created out of concern about Japan's declining birth rate. But as we've already discussed, that's probably just him patenting his own farts.
sorry, there's so many questions, but the one that stood out there for me was an invisible bee bust bra. That also begs the question, could the technology not cope with a C cup?
Is it like Scotty in Star Trek? Can it take
Can it hold them, Captain? Literally, can I hold them?
I didn't look in depth into his B-brust invention.
But the self-defense wig as well. I'm sorry. Combining those twin problems of being bald and people wanting to attack you. Why?
Yeah, in my mind, I imagine it's sort of what Oddjob uses when he forgets his hat.
His hair's got a flail hidden inside it.
Yes.
He claims that he developed the floppy disk 17 years before IBM, but what he actually patented was paper for an optical sound player. And in contrast to a floppy disk, his patent discloses the use of printed paper for storage instead of a magnetic material on a floppy disk. However, IBM did pay him out for 14 different patents, but they say they have nothing to do with a floppy disk. The impression I get is that IBM were like, oh, you're a tedious irritant. Just have the money and go away. He has won the grand prize at the International Exposition of Inventors a record 16 times, or so he says. He has been commemorated in the United States on a visit in 1988. A dozen cities from San Diego to Pittsburgh held a Dr. Nakamats Day. He's an honorary citizen of the state of Maryland. Congress awarded him a certificate of special recognition, and he even tossed out the first pitch at the Pittsburgh Pirates game. But I think he's a bad inventor because he adheres too much to the whole throw all the spaghetti at the wall using a patented Dr. Nakamats spaghetti hurler in order to some of it will stick.
Yeah.
He has also been awarded Ig Nobel Prizes.
Yes.
And in September 2015, when he appeared there, he performed a song about one of his medical conditions.
Oh, okay.
My God.
The things that he has made that are useful, I don't believe he's actually made. And everything else that he's made clearly isn't useful. And he's also, he's a dick about his family. When he was asked about the greatest invention ever, he said, well, a child can be invented in four ways. Smart seed, smart field. Smart seed, stupid field. Stupid seed, smart field. Stupid seed, stupid field. And how did your kids turn out, Dr. Nakamats? All stupid due to stupid field.
Wow.
He claims that he should now be called Sir Dr. Nakamats because he got an honorary title by the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. But the Sovereign Military Order of Malta have gone, no, you don't. And he still uses it. He's also somewhat troubling for his views. In 2010 and 2013...
You astound me with that revelation, Ben. Who would have thought a nonagenarian sex pest who has lied about inventing some of the most profitable inventions of the last 50 years could also possibly have troubling views? Go on.
Well, he ran as a candidate for the Happiness Realization Party. But rather than being the hippy-dippy socialist, you can imagine, they are actually the political wing of the conservative and anti-communist happy science religious movement.
Oh.
Amongst its manifesto is to more than double Japan's population to 300 million by making child rearing easier for mothers and actively accepting foreigners into the country. So it's, you know, it's not all horrendous right-wing invective. He also wants to change the pacifist Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, advocates Japan getting the nuclear deterrent, denies that the Nanking massacre ever occurred, and has called for China to be expelled from the United Nations Security Council. My absolute favourite thing about his political views is that when he ran for the governorship of Tokyo in 2003, gaining 110,000 votes, he claimed, I can make North Korean missiles do a 180-degree U-turn and go right back to the point of origin.
Those farts are so powerful.
Yeah. But in something that might have been taken out of a Boris Johnson speech, it's not a secret exactly, but if I tell you, the enemy might find out.
My nomination is Richard Pockridge. The reason I picked inventors in the first place is I kind of like that you can be something with no qualifications, or you don't have to prove that. I mean, we could all say now we're inventors. You don't need to like study for years or anything like that at all. You're just an inventor. All you need is a shed. Now, his dad was actually quite successful. His dad was an MP. He was wounded in the Siege of Athlone in the William Wright Wars, and his dad was actually quite inventive because his dad had this idea. They needed to cross a river, so he got three of his men and said, if you don't do this, I'm going to shoot you and kill you. What you need to do is run across the river, we'll pretend you're deserters, and then we're going to shoot after you the enemy think you're deserting us, and then run across the river and then see if it's safe. So this was the parentage he was born into.
Yeah.
So born in 1695 in Derryusk in Ireland. His dad died when Richard was 25. When you see the rest of his life, I think he died of embarrassment, to be honest with you. His dad died and he got an inheritance of about £4,000 a year, which I did like the calculator thing for inflation. And that's about £600,000 a year.
Ooh.
In today's money. And that's a really dangerous amount of money to have, because yeah. It's not small enough where you have to be careful and think and sort of just lead a normal life. But it's not big enough where you can just, fuck it, I'll buy a yacht. I don't care.
Yeah.
It's sort of somewhere in the middle where you just think, I'll be an idiot with it. I don't know what I'd do with 600 grand a year.
Invent some shit.
Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah, you kind of do that. So he preferred to be called Captain Pogridge, because why wouldn't you? You know, everybody wants to be called Captain Pogridge.
Yeah, well, I mean, Nakamatsu is, what is he, Sir Doctor at this point. He can be Captain whoever he likes.
So he was said to be the inspiration for the floating islands of Laputa in Gulliver's Travels.
Okay.
Oh.
Which, I don't know if you've read Gulliver's Travels. It's the island where everybody has kind of weird invention ideas.
Mm.
The only reason I've read Gulliver's Travels, I'll admit this now, when I was about 20, there was a girl I knew who I really fancied, and I couldn't think of a way to talk to her. And she was reading Gulliver's Travels. So I read all of Gulliver's Travels in like 4 days. I just crammed it to give myself an excuse to speak to her. And then the next time I saw it, she had the copy of the book on the table. I went, "Oh, Gulliver's Travels, how are you finding it?" She went, "I'm reading it for a course, I hate it."
I imagine you just went, "Well, I feel like a right Yahoo," and then walked out.
His contemporaries called him a mixture of quixotic and an enterprising scoundrel.
I wouldn't mind that being on my gravestone.
His first enterprise was a brewery in Dublin in about 1715. And it failed. I don't want to sort of go into stereotypes. Selling beer in 1700s in Dublin, and you can't make that a success.
To be fair, he also proposed building it at Island Bridge, which is very close to the location of the actual now Guinness brewery. So,
so it's like building your own theme park next to Disneyland.
Yeah.
Apparently, when he had his brewery, he entered one of his beers into a competition, like the best beer, and he lost. So what he did was, to console himself, he sat and drank the entire barrel that he'd entered into the competition.
Good Lord. Next year he used, like, "I'm going to enter this cheese competition and I either get to win or I'm going to have a lovely afternoon."
Yeah.
His next scheme was he wanted to open a tea room. He had it in his head that the best place to have it would be the Bishop of, and I maybe pronounced this wrong, so I apologize on the fact, is it Tuam or is it...
Tuam.
Tuam. So the Bishop of Tuam, he decided his house would be the best place to have this tea room. Because, obviously...
Did he give the bishop, like, a penny and, like, a little hat and have him going around serving the tea?
He gave him far better than that, because the Bishop of Tuam reasonably said, "I don't want my house being a tea room." He tried to bribe him with pigeons.
That he kept, like, up his sleeve, like a magician?
No, I think it's before, you know, the gold standard. Before the gold standard, there was the pigeon standard. It was just a common term for currency back in the day.
But the bishop didn't go for it, so that didn't work. So then he bought a load of barren mountain land in County Wicklow. Try and guess what for.
Sheep farming, or are they really barren?
Really barren. Smaller.
So we are animals. Chickens?
Geese.
Of course.
Geese are funnier. You're right. Yes, you're right, Richard.
Yeah, he had a geese farm halfway up a mountain in County Wicklow. And you won't be shocked that was also not a success.
Fine. I don't know how he kept finding investors for... Oh, no, he didn't need them. He was getting 600 grand a year.
He was poor for most of his life because basically he was an idiot. So his first sort of proper invention was an orchestra of drums.
Okay. And did he compose for the orchestra as well?
No. What he suggested was if there was an orchestra that was made entirely of drums and one person would play all the drums.
So he's invented the drum kit.
But a drum kit that would replace an orchestra.
He's invented Animal from the Muppets is what he's done.
So when that didn't work, he did go on to, he wanted to drain the bogs around where he lived to make vineyards, because that climate is famously perfect.
There are a couple of vineyards in Ireland, but they're all in the south, and the bogs in Ireland tend to be in the Midlands.
But his life seems to have been this series of, I've had an idea, I'm going to propose it to people. If they don't have the money themselves, I'm going to pay for it myself.
Yeah.
Try it, didn't work. Let's crack on with the next one. Because his next idea was, everybody in the country was going to have a pair of wings.
As well as my man who jumped off the Eiffel Tower, there's quite a lot of people around the 1880s, 1890s who were full-blown Icaruses and tried to make actual goose wings, but they never thought to mass-produce them.
Well, the thing is with it, he didn't appear to have invented a set of wings or have like a patent or anything like that. He just said, one day everybody will have a pair of wings.
Was it because he ran for Parliament a few times as well, didn't he? So he was it a campaign promise? A pair of wings in every household.
No, he actually said at one point in the future, it might be as common for men to call for their wings as they now call for their boots.
Oh, I like that. Marjorie, fetch my wings.
Did he have this idea just after he'd finished that entire barrel of beer at that competition?
And he was halfway up a mountain with geese. I need to get back home.
He did the glass organ as well. He invented one of those.
Possibly his only invention that kind of worked at all was that. He called it the angelic organ.
Angels, wings, that's where it's from. He loves
that's where it's all going from, yeah. And he actually toured with it, he performed with it, and he was Richard Pockridge and his angelic organ.
Sexy.
Yeah, absolutely. His invention was a wine glass with some water in it.
Yeah.
And then a wet finger and then around the top of the rim. So the angelic organ was a load of those in different pitches just in a tray in front of him. So that was his invention, was glasses and water.
Yeah.
Well, he'd probably need those after drinking the barrel full of booze.
To sober up a little bit.
Yeah.
So basically, that was it was the angelic organ, that was his thing. And he had a big performance set up in London that he was going to unveil this to, you know, the nation. But it was cancelled 3 hours before it was due to happen because, and so many performances are cancelled this way, because a runaway pig got into the theatre and knocked over all the glasses.
It is just the Muppets now. It is just the Muppets.
Yeah. Who released the pig?
A rival.
Apparently he was tuning up and he went backstage for a breath of fresh air or a fag or whatever. And it being London in the 1700s, a pig walked past, got into the theatre and mayhem ensued.
Oh my God. I can see why you were putting him forward as the world's worst inventor.
But it's the fact that his musical instrument can be absolutely ruined by it being a bit warm.
Yeah.
Water just evaporates out of the glasses and out-tunes it, or you've got a cat and gets thirsty, or just a runaway pig. And that was his big thing. But there's a really nice story that when his brewery was going into liquidation, he had bailiffs come round to his house, and he distracted them by playing his angelic harp. And a bottle of wine as well. And he played the harp, and apparently they were so enchanted that they let him off with the debt.
Oh, nice.
But that was the one that kind of lived on. He had, his big thing was blood transfusions.
Yeah.
And he would transfer the blood into a wine glass and then lick his finger. And that would make the devil's harp.
Yes.
He was a proponent of blood transfusions. The first human-to-human blood transfusion was by Dr. Philip Fizik.
Ha!
Great.
Which is just on point. Yeah. But that was in 1795. Richard thought that if you transferred blood from young people to old people, it would make the old people young again.
Oh, no.
He tried to patent being a vampire, basically.
Oh, Richard, you're so close to something actually, like, important. So close.
No, he actually said the redundant fermenting blood of the one will immediately flow like wine, decanted into the shriveling veins of the other. The wrinkled skin braces, the flesh pumps, the eyes sparkle.
Wow.
That needs to be read by Christopher Lee.
But he genuinely thought, yeah, if you transfer blood from young people to old people, it would make the young people old, young again.
What age was he when he died?
He actually said, what you need to do is you need to, quote, use servants or other physically active specimens.
Oh, no.
Now, how you catch the physically active
yes!
if you're quite old and wrinkly, I don't know. But he thought ahead of this. I know what you're thinking, because I know our Japanese professor, he's going to live to 144.
Mm, yep.
He had that beat in his invention. He said, there will be a problem, not with morality of sucking the blood out of young people, but immortality. People could end up immortal.
That was the problem.
So basically what he said was, once somebody reaches the age of 999, they can be pronounced dead. So their will can be enacted, and the local vicar can get the burial fee that he's been denied.
I thought you were going to say the problem is when people become 999, their age is just going to roll over again to zero,
yeah.
And they're going to become a baby.
The Y1K bug, basically. His wife married him because she thought he had money. He married his wife because he thought she had money, which is never a good marriage. But she ran away with an actor and well-known rake and drunken womanizer called Theophilus Cibber.
Oh, yes, we've come across him as well.
Basically, they drowned off the coast of Scotland.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
On an elopement endeavour.
Yeah. One of his relatives, a guy called Brockhill Newberg, thought he was such an idiot, he proposed he was going to write a 24-volume poem about what an idiot he was.
That is the most 18th century thing I've ever heard, though, in fairness.
In the end of his life, he said, well, what I want is for my body to be preserved in spirits so future generations can look at me and as an exhibit. But he died. He was burnt to a crisp in a coffee house.
Oh, no. Did he burn with sort of a light blue flame? Ben, you mentioned inventors who died at their own inventions' hands. Jim Fix, in 1977, basically popularized jogging as an athletic sport. He wrote a very famous book about, you know, athletic sport and running. When he was 52 years old, Jim Fix died of a heart attack while out on a jog.
Bill Hicks has a small routine about that, where it's basically just him laughing at the glorious irony of that.
Do you know when the first combat submarine was built, by the way?
The 2nd century BC.
By the ancient Egyptians. Neither Newton nor the Egyptians, you'll be sad here. US Civil War, which is still earlier than I kind of, in my head, would have expected. It was a guy called Horace Lawson Hunley was a marine engineer who invented it, and the CSS Hunley, he was taking it for a test in 1863, and it failed to resurface, and Hunley and 7 crew members drowned.
Which front of the American Civil War required naval warfare?
There were a lot of racist crabs to dealing with. So I read a bit about the history of Mother's Day, because the inventor of Mother's Day came to regret her invention. Mother's Day as a holiday was celebrated in the US in the 19th century. Before the Civil War, a woman called Anne Reeves Jarvis helped start Mother's Day work clubs to teach women about how to care for their children. They actually became sort of good places to unify people who'd been on opposite sides of the Civil War divide later on. Another precursor to Mother's Day, the suffragette Julia Ward Howe wrote the Mother's Day Proclamation as a call to action for mothers to unite in promoting world peace. The Mother's Day version that stuck was created by a woman called Anna Jarvis, the daughter of Anne Reeves Jarvis, the Civil War lady I just mentioned. So in 1908, she came up with Mother's Friendship Day to promote reconciliation again, so to carry on her mother's tradition. And she started it at her church, and she used white carnations as the symbol because they were her mother's favourite flower. The article I read said she was a virulent letter writer. So she campaigned very hard via letter writing to promote it to Congress and around the country, and it caught on. And as quickly as 1914, legislation was passed for the second Sunday in May to be Mother's Day in America. Jarvis, however, came to regret it for a very noble reason. At the start, carnations were 2 for a penny. 4 years later, carnations were 15 cents. And then you get the greetings card companies and the chocolatier company. Basically, the commercialization of the holiday absolutely appalled her. So she had initially worked with the floral industry to help, you know, raise the profile of the holiday. But by 1920, she like completely turned and she denounced the holiday, urged people to stop buying Mother's Day gifts, began campaigning against her, speaking out, launching lawsuits against groups that use the name Mother's Day, spending all of her own personal money in legal fees. She was lobbying the government to have it removed from the American calendar by the time of her death in 1948, at which point she was living alone in a sanatorium because she'd spent all of her money trying to undo the work that she'd done.
To go from sort of like, oh, it'd be nice to, no, it's absolutely evil.
And in fairness to her, she had a point. I presume you both know, and most of our listeners will know, the story of the Nobel Prize and Alfred Nobel.
Yeah, he was invented dynamite. I don't know the rest of it, but that's the headline.
Yeah, he seems like when he died, you know, he left us money to found a peace prize and other prizes in sciences. The story behind it is that his brother Ludwig died in 1888, and a French newspaper, thinking it was Alfred who had died, published an obituary calling him the Merchant of Death, which so shocked him that he set up the Nobel Prize. And he had it early in his career. He'd met the guy who had developed nitroglycerine, and Nobel himself invented a blasting cap, which helped contain the charge a little bit and made it safer, but not fully safe, because his own nitroglycerin factory blew up in 1864 and killed his younger brother and several other people.
Sorry, that's obviously very sad, but a nitroglycerin factory blowing up is objectively hilarious.
Yeah. And he went on to develop dynamite and took out a patent for it in 1867. He did invent other things like artificial silk, artificial leather. He registered about 350 patents in his lifetime. But yeah, the idea of being remembered as a merchant of death is said to be one of the reasons that he probably set up a peace prize.
That is the punchline. Yeah, you have sex with one sheep.
Yes. Yeah.
There's the alternative approach to him being named a merchant of death. Instead of rejecting it, he could have embraced it and become the greatest death metal band leader of all time.
Yeah. Alfred and the Nobles. He was also very good friends with the Austrian author and pacifist Bertha von Suttner. She won the Nobel Prize herself in 1905, actually, but she's said to have been maybe a big influence on him also changing his ways. And he is one of many people, Alfred Nobel, who went down thinking that he had invented something that might actually bring about an end to war. He thought his invention of dynamite was so destructive that it would stop people ever making war again. Orville Wright had a similar thought that, you know, he lived to see his plane used in combat in the First World War, and he said, "The aeroplane has made war so terrible, I do not believe any country will again care to start a war." And he still was alive during World War II and saw things that happened, and he said he had dared to hope that we had invented something that would bring lasting peace to the earth. But we were wrong. And they're also on the same list as Nikola Tesla, who in his lifetime was said to have been working on a so-called death ray, though he called it the teleforce.
If you're working on something and your mate say, "Well, what are you up to today?" You don't want to say a death ray, do you? You want to call it something else, don't you?
Well, you don't want to say something that's going to bring about the end of war, because apparently it's going to be a disaster. Tesla's death ray, the idea was that it would focus energy in such a way that it could bring down airplanes, you could build a fence around countries using this beam. And so basically it would make war impossible. Again, didn't really happen. When he died in a hotel in New York, and he was quite poor in his later life, and he tried to hawk the idea for this machine around and even announced that he'd invented it, but no governments really believed him. When he died, he said he was going to pay his bill to the hotel by giving them a box, and he said it contained a model to his death beam and it would be priceless and that they should use that to help settle his bill. And when he died, they opened the box and it just contained a few pieces of electronic components. Obviously, because of course it did. But he was a bit of a showman before he sort of went into these isolation hotels. He used to have an annual press conference on his birthday just to chat to the press about whatever he was up to on July the 10th. So when he turned 79, he announced he'd invented a pocket-sized oscillator that could destroy the Empire State Building.
But literally no other building.
Yeah, just the Empire State Building. And a year after that, when he turned 80, he said that his secret for long life was not lots of sex or anything like that we've already talked about, or blood transfusions. He said it was toe wriggling.
Excuse me?
You heard me, Ben. Toe wriggling. wriggling his toes. Presumably his own toes, not other people's toes.
So was he the businessman on the plane in Die Hard when he talks about making fists with your feet?
Yeah, that must be, yeah. It's an homage to Nikola Tesla. And I did read a little bit about a few people who also regretted their inventions but weren't killed by them. Tim Berners-Lee, who we have to thank for maybe the most influential invention of the last 100 years, the World Wide Web, he says that really, if you think about it, it doesn't need the two forward slashes. I could have designed it not to have the two forward slashes. Basically, his HTML invention, he has no idea why you put these two slashes that you have in every website address. So that's his biggest regret.
That's the thing that I really hate about the internet, rather than the ability of idiots and fascists all over the world to unite in chat rooms and on social media. Yeah, Tim, it's just those misplaced pieces of punctuation that have ruined everything.
Yeah. There was a guy called Bob Probst. He was a guy who invented open plan offices and the office cubicle. In the 1960s. In 1997, he said it was designed to give knowledge workers a more flexible, fluid environment than the rat maze boxes of offices. However, he said the cubicalizing of people in modern corporations is monolithic insanity. And Victor Grün, in 1954, in Detroit, opened his first invention, the shopping mall, because in a time of urban sprawl, fewer people lived close to the center of town where the shops were, so he thought this would be the solution. We'd have a place where people could come and do all the shopping and other errands. We'd have green spaces and art and lovely things, and of course, shopping centers the world over are like hanging gardens of Babylon, aren't they? He was appalled by it. In 1978, he said, "I would like to take this opportunity to disclaim paternity once and for all. I refuse to pay alimony to those bastard developments. They destroyed our cities."
So basically, the two people who are in the inventors of modern America both regret it.
Yes. I have a main candidate, but I just want to mention briefly Smell-O-Vision.
That's not a thing.
Smell-O-Vision very much was a thing. In 1929, during a showing of the Broadway Melody, a New York City theatre sprayed perfume from its ceiling. And Arthur Mayer installed an in-theatre smell system in Paramount's Rialto Theatre on Broadway in 1933, which delivered smells into the cinema during films. But it would take over an hour for the scents to clear afterwards, and sometimes even days after you could still smell the smells. Walt Disney even thought about including smells in Fantasia. So he was the first filmmaker to think of specifically attaching certain scents to his film rather than a cinema owner taking the steps to do it. And even GE, General Electric, in 1953 developed Smell-O-Rama. Smell-O-Vision itself was developed by Michael Todd Jr. The name Mike Todd Sr. might be familiar to you. He was the third husband of Liz Taylor. The only one she didn't divorce. He died in a plane crash, I believe.
I thought he was beheaded by Henry VIII.
Mike Todd Jr. had a very short-lived spell where he promoted Smell-O-Vision using a 1960 film that he had commissioned specifically to launch the equipment called Scent of Mystery.
Please tell me it wasn't an adult film. Because...
No, it wasn't. The actual Smell-O-Vision technique, which involved injecting 30 odors into the theatre's seats, triggered by the soundtrack, that was developed by a guy called Hans Laube, but obviously Todd was the producer behind the film. They understood that they couldn't really use it, it wouldn't really fit with like a drama, so they went for a mystery comedy called Scent of Mystery, which was directed by a guy called Jack Cardiff, who called it the one film I want to erase from my memory. The synopsis is a mystery novelist played by Denham Elliott, who's also in Indiana Jones, discovers a plan to murder an American heiress played by Liz Taylor, using his stepmother in an uncredited role to her credit, while on vacation in Spain. He enlists the help of a taxi driver played by Peter Lorre to travel across the Spanish countryside to thwart the crime. It's got an amazing cast. Leo McKern, who went on to be Rumpel of the Bailey, is in it. Diana Dors is in it. But it was terrible. During the filming, Peter Lorre suffered a heart attack, so they had to use a body double for most of Peter Lorre's scenes. And again, halfway through filming, they got sent some of the scents from the lab in Switzerland where they were developed. And Cardiff said, "It's hard to believe, but each labelled glass smelled exactly the same as the others, like a very cheap eau de cologne. The smells were nothing. They were a fake." However, ads for the film proclaimed, "First they moved, brackets 1895. Then they talked, brackets 1927. Now they smell." And there was a rival thing called Aromarama. They released a travelogue called Behind the Great Wall around the same time, and Variety, I think, labelled it the Battle of the Smellies. That is not going to be my choice. My choice for the world's worst inventor is John McAfee.
Oh, yes.
We've all, in various points, had our computers tell us that we need to update our McAfee software. He is an American computer programmer and businessman who founded McAfee Associates, or McAfee Associates, in 1987, ran it until 1994. So he has a large claim to have invented antivirus software. I mean, if you don't follow him on Twitter, guys, it's worth going and having a trawl back down through there. He left the company because he announced that a computer virus called Michelangelo was going to erase the hard drives of millions of computers if they didn't have antivirus software on them. Obviously, boosting his own company's sales massively. Then the number affected was tiny. And so he left the company in 1994 with a payoff of $100 million, most of which, you'll be glad to hear, he has squandered. McAfee in 2014 was basically, it was owned by Intel, and Iltaz said all McAfee products are now going to be marketed as Intel Security. John McAfee expressed his pleasure by saying, "I am now everlastingly grateful to Intel for freeing me from this terrible association with the worst software on the planet." He has a history of doing down his own inventions. He, in an article, he said he was the most popular hacking target by hackers because they saw him as a badge of honor. And so he gets other people to buy his computer equipment for him and uses pseudonyms when setting up computers and so on. But when he was asked if he uses McAfee's antivirus software, he said, "I take it off. It's too annoying." And in 2013, he uploaded a parody video on YouTube called "How to Uninstall McAfee Antivirus." He addresses its failings and criticizes it while snorting a white powder and being stroked and undressed by scantily clad women.
Your move, Bill Gates.
Your move. But I mean, that's not the only thing he's famous for. He's wanted for murder in Belize, or at least he's suspected of having committed murder in Belize, allegedly, for the protection of the podcast. But also in 2016, after the San Bernardino shootings, you might remember, there was a talk about how to infiltrate the shooter's iPhone, and Apple were being pressured to create a backdoor into the encrypted software. McAfee said he would be able to decrypt it himself without a backdoor. He later admitted that his claims of cracking the phone were a publicity stunt. What a classy guy. classy guy. He's contended that taxes are illegal, and in 2019 says he hasn't completed a tax return in 2010, referring to himself as a prime target of the IRS. On Twitter in 2017, he predicted the price of one Bitcoin would jump to $500,000 within 3 years, saying, "If not, I will eat my own dick on national television." And November that year increased his prediction to $1 million. In January 2020, he said on Twitter he had been doing that simply as a ruse to onboard new users because he was an investor in Bitcoin at the time. A month ago, he tweeted, "Despite my efforts, brackets, licking handles of grocery carts, bottom of my shoes, etc., I'm unable to get coronavirus to challenge me," alongside photos of him showing negative virus tests and licking the bottom of a sneaker. He's also said on Twitter that he has 47 biological children. But the thing that stands out most on his Twitter account, and by the way, he's run to be candidate for the Libertarian Party as president a couple of times as well.
Of course he has.
Because of course he has. During one of those runs, he tweeted, June 2018, "Whale fucking. No joke. Each year on February 1st in the Molokai Channel, a few men compete in the world's only whale fucking contest. Humpback whales are easy to fuck for a second or less. World record, 31 seconds. I competed once. Almost got my ribs crushed. Stick with ostriches."
I mean, you've got to admire his ambition.
Just the idea that having sex with ostriches is like vanilla.
Yeah. He followed that up by saying, "Enough with the whale." Some people were saying it's not consensual, and their animal rights people protest, and he said, "Enough of the whale fucking is non-consensual bullshit. A humpback whale weighs 70,000 pounds, is 50 feet long, can dive more than a quarter mile, and can crush ships with a single swipe of its tail. If a human manages to fuck one, you damn well better believe it's consensual."
I mean, I have no respect for most of what he's done, but on that I absolutely agree with him.
Except the most annoying thing about him, Ben, is this. He talks about this in an article while he was running to be Libertarian candidate for president, and he writes, My largest experiment was whale fucking, which tested a person's gullibility, a powerful form of imposed ignorance. I claimed to be part of a whale fucking club in Hawaii, the members of which had sex with humpback whales. Anyone who considered for a moment would see the impossibility. I even spelled out this impossibility, but couched it in the terms of, is whale fucking consensual? We then selected 100 random commenters on my various whale fucking tweets and asked them two questions. One, do people really fuck whales? Two, has John McAfee fucked a whale? 62% answered yes to the first question. 41% answered yes to the second question. What this shows is that disinformation, which is ignorance of the truth, is simple to impose, even if logic denies it. What is even simpler is discovering a person's ignorance set without imparting knowledge. So, John McAfee invented a product which is useful but also annoying, disavowed it in, like, shockingly weird terms, has lived a really atrocious life, and yet he has proved to us the power of fake news and basically made whale fucking a comment on the modern tendency towards believing conspiracies. And I hate him for being so fucking right about that above everything else. So that is why I'm putting him forward as the world's worst inventor. So, our candidates this week for the world's worst inventor is Ben's suggestion of Sir Dr. Nakamats. The long-lived, I don't even remember, the man who invented everything, let's say. Nick's suggestion of Richard Pockridge, the idiot son who squandered all his father's money on things like Irish vineyards and glass organs. And my suggestion of John McAfee, not even the world's worst libertarian.
In a very crowded field.
Very crowded.
Yeah.
Very.
I mean, surely the world's worst libertarian is Jeremy Corbyn.
He's terrible at it.
Yeah.
You're so right, Ben. I don't know what I was thinking. You know what? I'm sorry, guys. I'm going with John McAfee. He annoys me so much. Richard Pockridge is great. He's right in the area we quite would like him to be, of just like idiot. Someone from the past invented loads of stuff, barmy. Dr. Sir Nakamats with his, you know, claiming to basically that everything he touches, he says he's invented. He's like a child walking around picking up a friend's toys and going, I own this now. Just Jesus, John McAfee is so annoying and so brazen with how annoying he is and leaning into his annoyance. I nearly threw my computer across the room.
McAfee is like if you had Elon Musk and Gary Busey in a room together.
Yes! An older, more cantankerous Elon Musk, and I hate him for it.
I first read about McAfee's misdemeanors a few years ago, I was like, no, yeah. It must be a different McAfee, because you've just got to, all people who make computer virus software, they're all, you know, ugly pullover wearing nerds.
Yeah.
And yet this guy looks like he should be hosting Extreme Crocodile Hunters on 5-star.
Yeah, he definitely needs his own reality TV. No, he doesn't. Oh my god, what did I just say? I'm deleting that from the podcast. Listen, before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's best news, and this is a headline I've just seen on the RT News website, which is that Pope Francis praises divine pleasures of food and sex. So the shackles are off, guys. Papa Frankie says it's all right to basically eat pizza and fuck the night away.
Has he been reading some of Dr. Nakamats's advice?
No, there's a new book of interviews, and he says that he believes that the pleasures of a well-cooked meal or loving sexual intercourse are divine, and they have unjustly fallen victim to overzealousness on the part of the Catholic Church in the past.
That sounds like his Tinder profile.
Yeah, he says
the pleasures of a pizza and a night of sexual intercourse. What about it?
Yeah. He says the church has condemned inhuman, brutish, vulgar pleasures, but has, on the other hand, always accepted human, simple, moral pleasure. So, I mean, don't read it too closely. I'm for the good news section, I'm sticking with the headline where the Pope says it's all right to have sex and eat lots. Given that we're heading quite fast for a second lockdown, that's good news for all of us, I'd say. Before we go, Nick, where can people find out more about you and your work and buy your book and all of those things?
Twitter, Nick_Pettigrew. If you type Nick Pettigrew antisocial into a web browser and buy the book from all good bookstores and some rubbish ones as well.
Well, meanwhile, we're all off to try and plant some vines in the rolling vineyards of Essex and see what we can produce. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.